read 69 cantos for melancholy brunettes and sad women.
I wanted to start with checking in on what's happened since the release of your last album, Jubilee. It's been a few years, and following the success of that album and then the release of Crying in H Mart, what have you been up to since 2021? And I guess, have you managed to get any downtime since then?
Yeah, I actually took all of 2024 off for kind of a sabbatical year. I was living in Korea for a year just as a humble student learning the language. I mean, honestly, it was to work on a second book, but it was mostly just to take a year off and focus on being alive. So that was a really wonderful year for me. And even though I already really miss it, I feel like I've had the time I need to kind of recollect myself and do the whole thing again.
So when was it that you started on the new album in relation to the last one, Jubilee?
I mean, I was still touring Jubilee, I think, through October of 2023. And I mean, we had sort of taken less gigs in that year, and I had started writing the record and then recorded it in LA in December of 2023. And then I went to Korea and went sort of back and forth on mixing just through email and mastering, and then recorded all of the music videos and shot the album cover and did kind of all the visual stuff while I was living in Korea. I mean, the oldest song on the record is called Men in Bars, and it was on an EP I did that was kind of like a COVID project called Bumper. It was like a city pop EP, and it was called Ballad O. And it was just one of those songs that I was never really happy with the arrangement of, and then I wanted to revisit it almost as like a country murder ballad. And so that's the oldest song. I didn't write it at that time thinking this is going to go on the record, but it kind of made sense to put it on there later. I think the first single, honestly, Orlando in Love, came pretty early and sort of felt like thesis of the record. I was up in upstate New York writing that. And yeah, most of the album kind of came together in 2023.
Last night's dream.
In those early days when you first started on this new one, did you have any perspective on what you expected the fourth Japanese Breakfast album to look like? And as a follow-up to that, how different is the final product from those initial ideas?
Yeah, so I always have these big concepts in mind and then realize it's very hard to stick to, and they get kind of broader over time. So I knew after Jubilee, which was a joyful record and the palette was bright yellow, and we were using a lot of strings and horns and synthesizers, the arrangements were really large. I think I wanted to do, I originally wanted to make a creepy album, because I was like, what is something really unexpected from me after making an album about joy? And I was like, what if I made a creepy album? And then I wrote Honey Water and Mega Circuit that kind of fit into that concept, but it was really hard for me to come up with like 8 other songs that kind of fit that tone. No matter how much I tried to write in that direction, it was just not very natural for me. And so I kind of broadened the concept and theme to be about melancholy. And they are kind of songs, they're kind of moral tales in a way. They're kind of about people who sort of break the balance of their lives and find themselves tilted too far on one edge, about to fall in or falling into some kind of consequence. And that was what I ran with that seemed more plausible. I knew that the palette in terms of color was going to be darker, and I knew that I really wanted to play more guitar, kind of return to guitar-based songwriting, and I really wanted to go back for the live show to playing guitar, because I wasn't I felt very uncomfortable in my role as a singer for 3 years, you know, because Jubilee was such a big arrangement that there wasn't really a place for me to play guitar. And so that was really important to me for this record. Yeah, I would say it turned out to be what I wanted. I really loved the record, but it was probably different. I wanted to make a creepy Nine Inch Nails, like Kid A type of album, and I definitely didn't accomplish that.
Talk to me about melancholy for a second. Was that something that you intentionally went after, or was there something that sparked that as a concept?
I mean, I think it was just naturally the way that I was feeling. I feel like it's a very mature and very contemplative record. I don't know. I mean, it just feels melancholic. It feels like my natural state, I guess. I think in a way, it's like I'm finally, after 10 years, returning to my natural state. After writing about grief and then sort of giving myself permission to feel joy, I get to sort of return to my neutral, melancholic, sort of sad, pensive self. So I think that it just was what I was feeling at the time, and, you know, that was, it sort of came out in the songs.
I want to touch on Blake Mills here. How did you meet them, and what was it like having them come on board for this album as a producer?
Including my former band, this is my 7th record. And so I've actually never made a studio album, and I've never worked with a producer that's sort of just known for being a producer that I don't know personally. And so it felt really time for me to kind of invite that into my artistic life. And I wanted to work with a producer who had a strong point of view and could take me out of my comfort zone. So I met with a few producers, and when I met Blake in LA, we worked on the song Mega Circuit at Sound City, and it was weird but unique and inspiring experience, and I really loved what we made together and felt that he would be a good person to take me to sort of a new place in recording. I think that one really cool thing that Blake brings to the table is that he spent a lot of years as a session guitar player and is based in LA and has like such an incredible network of people. And I've never, again, like I've never had that experience of working with session musicians. And I remember when we were working on the demo together for Mega Circuit, he wanted to call in Jim Keltner, who is just a legend. He was in the Traveling Wilburys, he played on Dolly Parton records, he played on Bob Dylan albums, he played on Randy Newman and Carly Simon records. Any major huge song that you can think of, like, there's a big chance that Jim Keltner maybe played drums on their records. And so it was just a really wild experience to get to see that man drum and work and like what kind of feel he could bring to the song. I mean, there were moments where he played certain fills that I was like, oh, that feels like a mistake. And Blake would be like, oh no, it just has character. And it felt really uncomfortable a lot of the time, like, because I wasn't sure. And it took me maybe the entire recording process to be like, oh yeah, it just has character. And also he brought in Matt Chamberlain too, who played on Fiona Apple records, he played on Wallflower records. He also like has a huge, incredible discography of albums that he plays drums on. So yeah, it was just really an interesting experience to get to see how those people work.
Where was it that you ended up doing all of the recording? Did you end up doing it at Sound City as well?
Yeah, all of the record was recorded in Sound City, which was very new for me. I've never recorded a record in a studio. I usually record just like in friends', not quite bedroom studios, but like warehouse studios, you know? So it's kind of, over the years I've realized, even though there's something to be said for how creative and kind of limitless it feels to be just like with your friend, in a place that doesn't cost like thousands of dollars a day to just feel comfortable and be creative and try things on. Over the years, as I was like recording sessions and stuff like that, you notice there is a real marked difference in certain rooms and different microphones and preamps that you just can't quite get from home recording. And it felt really time to take that next step. And it kind of felt like something that I had in my back pocket that I've never done before. So yeah, we recorded it all in one place in Sound City, which was a really unique experience. Just passes you by.
As my final question here, I always like to ask artists if there's anything that marked the end of the album process for them. In these past few years, while you've been creating for Melancholy Brunettes and Sad Women, when did you start to see the light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, my experience with that has changed over the years. You know, I remember when I finished Jubilee and we had to postpone it a year because of COVID. And it was so, you know, at the time before we knew really what was going on, I so selfishly was just like, I am experiencing the worst of this situation, which is so selfish and naive. But, you know, honestly, because I went to Korea too, similar to Jubilee, this record had to be just sat on for a year. And I've gotten kind of comfortable with that process of just getting cozy with an album and letting it sit there and believing in it even after time has passed. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't think it feels done until it starts to come out, really. Like I kind of feel like I won't feel done with it maybe until like we start playing the shows and stuff and we start sharing it with the world. But yeah, I mean, I guess the last day in the studio also feels like a big ending. When you take the album cover photo, that was also a really big moment. I think maybe that was when I was like, okay, I'm not gonna touch this anymore. Like the album photo is shot, and it began to really take on an identity when the album photo was shot, and it kind of felt like a stamp of this is the end. Chained to my reflection in the shadow of a mountain. This is Japanese Breakfast, and you're listening to BFM.